Everyone, and welcome back to church. Last week, I hope that you enjoyed the time that you spent outside in the snow or inside in the warmth, whichever was better for you. I did a little of both. Freezing in the snow made it better to be in front of the fire. But I'm thankful to be here with you this morning and to be back. If you were here in the first 2 weeks in January, then you might have noticed that I had been preaching each one of those weeks in the same book, the book of Jeremiah. And I'm going to continue that this morning. Before I get into it, as I'm sure there are some of you in here who are familiar with Jeremiah and others who are not, I want to start by asking you to think of this one word, hope. And I don't want you to think of it as an abstract thing, but as a word which, in some way, I'm absolutely sure is meaningful to every one of you. Anyone who lives through challenging times in life knows how important hope is, right? And the harder life gets, the more important it is not to lose hope. The more challenging things are day to day. And I know that maybe all of you have in your own lives some form of challenge. And when that's true, it means that it's even more important to have hope. The darker it gets, the more important is the light which hope shines into the darkness. Isn't that right? And so before we go to Jeremiah, I'd ask each one of you in your own way to let that thing in life which you don't have right now, which you hope for, come into your minds. And for some of you, that will be easy, and it's profound and enormous. And it takes all the energy that you have moment by moment not to break down because you don't have that thing, that good thing. And I don't mean some trifling little trinket, but I mean the kind of peace that you know you were made for because you all know it. No matter what you believe about God, deep down inside, you know it. For others, it might be harder to grasp what that thing is, but try for a moment. What is the thing you hope for? Living without what you hope for is like living in exile. Have you heard that word, exile? It's an enormously important word in the history of God's people in the Bible. It's one of the defining events of God's people, who are referred to as the people of Jacob or Israel, the Hebrews, the Jews. They lived through a time period where they, in their lives, did not have what they were hoping for. And it was called the exile. In our own day, the easiest way to imagine it is what it might be like to be a refugee. Have some of you paid attention in the news to what it's like for people who are having to flee the place where they lived in relative peace to go somewhere else? Have some of you been following that? And we have a guy in our own congregation who just up and left during his vacation and went to Greece just to try to help with the refugees there. Some of you have talked to Alex about that. Many of you won't know him, but he talked to me after my sermon 2 weeks ago, because in that sermon I talked about what it was like to be in exile, and he told me what it was like to live amongst those refugees. I know that some of you in your own lives have those areas where you are hopeless, where you feel like you are, like a refugee, far from what is good and far from what is hopeful. And this morning, what I want to show you very plainly is a word of hope for every one of us who in one measure or another is in exile from the book of Jeremiah. It's a word of hope, and that means it's a very promising and positive word. When I spoke last about God's plans 2 weeks ago, I was, you know, I kind of joked this wasn't something that you'd see on Needlepoint because it wasn't all that hopeful in some ways, right? There were some people who scolded me after that. Well, this is a makeup, okay? And it's not a makeup because I feel anxious to you know, say something positive after some challenging words, but it's a word of hope that comes very simply from the book of Jeremiah, which, if you read through it, you may not find Jeremiah to be the most hopeful person. Those of us who have read through the book of Jeremiah will know that if he is an expert in anything, it's an expert in grief. When Michelangelo painted on the Sistine Chapel, you know, the different images of the prophets, Jeremiah's picture is something like this. And when Rembrandt painted him, it's just one hand, but equal grief. And his nickname is the Weeping Prophet. And here's why. Listen, Jeremiah had a sensitive heart, And what he saw when he looked at God's people, and I actually think it's what anyone who's got open eyes nowadays sees when they look at the world around them, is a large collection of people who are hurting themselves by going away from God. I don't know what your faith is, but I want you to understand that it is historically to me so very obvious that every time a man or a woman or a group of people move away from God, it is to their own detriment. And Jeremiah saw that, and it hurt him really deeply. And what he did is he said to the people over and over again, you must return to God. And you know what the people said? We don't want to. We want to go our own way. They were, in the potter's hands, they were very stubborn clay. They didn't yield. And so what happened is they went off into exile, and they met the fate which they had run toward by their disobedience to God. And then what Jeremiah did in his grief is what he always did, which is he opened his ears to God. And in chapter 30 of the book of Jeremiah, which, as I've said, is mostly not a hopeful book. In chapter 30, listen to the way this chapter starts. The word of the Lord that came to Jeremiah from God was this: write in a book all the words that I have spoken to you, for the days are surely coming, says the Lord, when I will restore the fortunes of my people. That is, God said to Jeremiah, I want you to collect a word of hope because I'm going to do something good for my people. And in the three chapters that come, 30, 31, 32, they call it the book of consolation within an otherwise really challenging book, because in those chapters there are words of great hope and promise for God's people then, and now here's my point for you, they're also for us. And so I want to set them before you this morning, and this is what I want you to hear. You're going to hear, very simply, a word of promise that was from God to the people in exile, and you should hear them in some measure as words to you in the ways that you're in exile. But in addition to promise, he also paints five pictures of what it will look like when God redeems his people. And they're beautiful. And I almost always only give 3 points in a sermon. But since we didn't have church last week, you get 5 this week. But before we look at them together, one more thing I'm going to ask you to do so that you're able to hear these words as they would have been heard by the original hearers. And that's important. For us to really hear what God has to say to us, we have to hear what he said to them. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I want you to try to get yourself into the mindset of the exile. And for some of you, you're already there, okay? But if you're not, here's what I want you to imagine. These three things. First, imagine that you've always deep down believed that God was good and that he really loves you. Now, some of you believe that. Some of you haven't believed that, but I want you to try to imagine that was true for you. That's number one. Now I want you to imagine, secondly, that life has become so unbearably difficult for you that it has become extremely hard to believe that first thing. That the way life really is so challenging that it's really a big question mark for you as to whether God does in fact love you and is in fact good. That's what all the exiles would have felt. So imagine that, would you? Can you do that? Some of you are there already. Here's the third one, and this also is true of the exiles. Imagine that even though life is just that bad, there is a flicker of hope deep down inside of your heart. It's like a candle buried in caves beneath the greatest mountains, but it's still burning. And it's the part of you that says, even though everything around me says otherwise, I still deep down inside can't help but believe that God is good and that he does love me. I'm hoping. That's where the exiles were when these words from Jeremiah first came to them. And this is Jeremiah 31, verses 10 through 14. Listen for the promise and the pictures of what redeemed life will look like. As I read, I'm going to pause along the way and then we'll come back to the pictures. Verse 10, hear the word of the Lord, O nations, and declare it in the coastlands far away. That's just a way of saying, I want everyone in the whole world to hear this. This is not just a word for one group, but for everyone. Say, he who scattered Israel will gather him. That's a word of promise of future salvation. And he will keep him as a shepherd a flock. That's a first picture of what life will be like, a shepherd keeping his sheep. Verse 11, for the Lord has ransomed Jacob and has redeemed him from hands too strong for him. That's a word of promise that God will save. Verse 12, they shall come and sing aloud on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the goodness of the Lord, over the grain, the wine, and the oil, and over the young of the flock and the herd. That's a second picture of what it will be like, a choir radiant on a hill. Their life shall become like a watered garden, and they shall never languish again. Are there any gardeners in here? Are there? A watered garden. That's what life will be like. That's another picture. That's the third one. And, you know, if this was just like, if we hadn't skipped church last week, that'd be it. But here's the last two. Verse 13, then shall the young women rejoice in the dance, and the young men and the old shall be merry. I will turn their mourning into joy. I will comfort them and give them gladness for sorrow. That's a fourth picture. An exchange is going to happen. You weigh all the sorrow and sadness and grief in your life. You put it on one side of the scale, and that's just how happy you will be. A joyful dance. I can't dance, but I love it anyway. And then here's the fifth. Verse 14, I will give the priests, their fill of fatness. Your preacher is going to gain weight. And my people shall be satisfied with my bounty. That's a picture of a great feast where everyone has more than enough. Now listen, I want to talk about these five pictures and I want to reflect on them. This is what I'm asking you to do with me. From the perspective of the exiles who heard them first. And I want to do that first because I believe it's the first step toward what really, really matters. And that is for you, my friends, for you to hear these words for you personally. They are for you. They're for all of us. And I want us to hear them and take them into our hearts and let them shape us. What would it have sounded like to the person in exile to hear these words and to picture this kind of life? Can you imagine already how deeply and desperately they would want it to be so? And if you can't put yourself there, just think about your own life and your own hopes where things aren't as you wish they were, and just try to connect for a moment with how awful it feels when you personally hope for something great, but it's just not happening. That's where these first listeners were. They were in the place of living day by day by day without getting what they deeply longed for and what they should have had. And then come these pictures from the prophet of what life will be like. And they are so brilliant and beautiful that I want you to look at the first one with me. And if I can have some help from the person who's working the slides in the back. Thanks. We're going to start and just go through them, all five of them. The first one is the promise that God will gather the people and bring them together like a shepherd does his flock. We have a disadvantage over the first hearers because we, living in our own day, have a hard time picturing the immediacy of a shepherd and a flock. You'll notice if you read the Old Testament that it's one of the most common images used all over the poetry and even the prophets of God's people, because everyone who read this right away would have known what it meant when a sheep was scattered away from the flock. To be a scattered sheep was an excellent picture for what exile was like. Think with me for just a moment about exile. Imagine that you'd been torn away from the home where you grew up, the environment that you knew, the neighbors that you lived around, the family members who you depended upon and who were close enough for you to walk to be with every day, and right there in the shadow of the great temple where God worshiped. Imagine that you had that life, and you went from that life to a life where you were torn away from it, and you were off in a foreign land by yourself, alone, far away from everything that you had known earlier, from your family and from your friends, and most importantly, from the closeness of God who dwelt in that temple where you were always close to. Can you picture all of that going away? That's what it's like to be a sheep separated from the flock. And to be a sheep, and think about this with me for a moment, to be a sheep that's far away from the flock means something very, very definite. To put it simply, once the sheep is separated, everything is bad. Everything. Because the sheep needs the security of the rest of the herd, the companionship that comes from being near others who are close to you and who get you, because they're also dumb like you, a sheep. And you need them. And you need them because a sheep has no natural defenses. And in the world out there, there are plenty, plenty of enemies that are much stronger and much more clever. And so the sheep who's separated from the flock is lost, is frightened, is uncertain of what's going to happen, is unable to provide for itself the very basic necessities it needs, food and water. And almost always when sheep get separated, they just give up. They lie down and they prepare to die. That's what really happens. And these first listeners would know. And as they heard this image described, they would think, yes, I am like a sheep that has been separated. And you know, the worst of it is not all those other things, but this, that the sheep is really far away from the one thing it needs most, which is the shepherd. Can you relate to that? In any place in your life feeling like that, I'm sure the exiles could. And then they hear this word, this picture, that God is going to come to them and gather them like a sheep will gather his shepherd, a shepherd will gather his sheep, and he will keep them. And that is a promise that says, you who are lost and far away, you are not forgotten by the shepherd, God. And he is on his way to come and gather you up and bring you back and give you absolutely everything that you need but cannot provide for yourself. Can you imagine how good it would feel back then to hear that promise? Can you? It's really good, isn't it? It meets that desperate need in you to feel secure and provided for, which you have. That's the first. Let's look at the second one. The second image comes down in verse 12. Then they shall come and sing aloud on the height of Zion, and they shall be radiant over the goodness of the Lord. Has anyone in here ever participated in a choir? Like, it's kind of, you don't want to really admit it because it's kind of out nowadays. Yeah. But isn't there something about singing together with a large group of other people who are lifting their voices as one, that is just unbelievably inspiring and powerful, isn't there? And imagine that choir outside on a great hill, lifting its voice in praise, because the people who are gathered in it are just so happy, they cannot keep from singing. They can't keep it in anymore, they're so glad, and it just comes out of them and it radiates. Radiant means something that emanates from inside outward in a way that is joyful and glad and public. Everyone can see it. Radiating is like heat spreading out to warm those who are nearby, or light spreading out in the darkness. And the image here is that you will be like a choir on the hill of Zion. Do some of you know what Zion is? Zion was the name for the hill that overlooked the city of Jerusalem. And in the tradition of these people who first heard these words, Zion was the center of the universe. They actually believed that. And the reason they believed it was the center of the universe is because they believed that's where God himself had chosen to dwell, in the temple. And so here comes a word to people whose lives could not be anything less like this. That you will come and you will be at the center of everything where God is, and you will be so glad and joyful, you will radiate joy as you sing together with your voices lifted on high. The promise seems impossibly good because of how difficult their lives were and how bad their lives were. The poets who wrote about exile described their situation like this: my tongue cleaves to the roof of my mouth. Cleave means sticks to in a way that cannot be torn apart. And that poetic image, think of it for a moment, that my tongue cleaves to the roof of my mouth, is an image of how bad grief can get. Has anyone in here ever been so sad they can't even speak? Have you ever experienced that? Some of you have recently. It's awful. to be receiving news or facing the reality of life and to have it be so bad you can't say anything. And that's what the poet said life was like in exile. Their musicians hung up their instruments on the boughs of the willows, and they sat down by the riverbeds, and they just wept because they didn't have songs in their heart anymore. They only had tears. Grief had shut them up. Grief had stolen the music from their hearts. You know how good it is when music lifts you up, right? When you listen to your favorite CD and it's just so good. Imagine you can't even get joy from music. Can you imagine that? That's what it was like for the exiles. And what God says to them is, you know what's going to happen? You're going to sing. It's going to be so good. You're going to gather with everybody together and you're going to lift your voices and it's going to be radiant over God's goodness. Over God's goodness. That you will be so aware of how good God is, you can't stop singing. Can you imagine how good that would be to hear that promise? That's only the second one. Here's the third one. It's for those who live and breathe gardening. And again, there's very few of us nowadays who do. But he tells them, your life will be like a watered garden. And I love this phrase. They shall never languish again. That word languish, it's an old-fashioned word, but it is absolutely profound. It's so perfect. Languish, look it up in the dictionary if you like. Languish means to suffer in life because you are stuck in terrible circumstances. That's what languish means. To be stuck and trapped somewhere that's not good and to be suffering because of it. Do you know what that's like? The exiles sure knew what it was like. They were stuck in a place where life began to just languish because they were trapped and they couldn't get away from this terrible place where they were. And to those people, this image comes. Your life is actually going to be like a watered garden. Do you know that in ancient literature, in the Bible we see this, and in all other ancient cultures that try to express what paradise is going to look like, do you know that the image of the garden almost always shows up? It's not just in our own scriptures where Adam and Eve are placed in paradise and it's a garden, but all over the ancient Near East, that was the image for true life and for paradise. Because if you know what a garden is like, it makes a lot of sense. Think about it. A garden is a peaceful place. Now, my wife, Michelle, for years, used to make a garden in the house where we live. And no matter what was going on in life, if she went out and began to work in the garden, it was like all of her stress evaporated. And it was something about the slow and steady work of taking out the weeds and putting the water on and seeing those little first signs of life that was really rewarding. Because in a garden, the work that you do turns into something good down the road, step by step. And it's just so good to have that truth in life. You know the opposite, right? Where you feel like you're working and you're trying and nothing comes together. It's like, you know, one time we saw the plants come up and we were ready to eat them. And then the day before we harvested them, the rats ate everything. That happened in my house. But life feels like that, doesn't it? But here the image is, you'll be like a well-watered garden. Which means your life will be peaceful. It will be productive. It will be growing slowly, day by day. The work that you put in will pay off. You'll see rewards for the things that you do day by day by day. And this is even better. They also knew, these first listeners knew, that in their environment, a garden was only as good as the weather was. Do you know what I mean by that? Think about it for a moment. They didn't have irrigation. And it's a very dry and arid environment. And that means when it was raining, because the weather was good for the garden, it would grow. But if there was a dry season, that would be it. The garden would die. You see that? And you know how often our own lives and our own experience of life can depend on the weather. And I don't just mean the literal weather, although that makes a difference too. But don't you know how your life can so easily be determined by the circumstances that you can't control? Do you know that? It's not just your life will be like a garden, but like a watered garden. You see that word watered. Do you know what that implies? You just think of it for a moment. There's a gardener who's coming every day to that garden with water. You see that? He's saying to those lives, those people in exile, your life is not going to depend on circumstances anymore. You're going to grow steadily because there is going to be a source of water that doesn't depend on the weather. It's going to be brought to you day by day, so you'll always be growing. Isn't that amazing? Let's look at the next one. verse 13, then shall the young women rejoice in the dance, and the young men and the old shall be merry. In Hebrew, it says the young maidens will be cheerful, and then it says the youths and the graybeards will make merriment together. I wish they hadn't changed that. The graybeards. Think of that image for a moment. And some of you love dancing and you're good at it. And I don't love dancing and I'm not good at it, so I don't go out and do it usually. But I know that when people get moving to the music, there's something so good and fun about that. Am I right? I mean, I'm guessing from the outside the way people look. Is that true? And how uncommon is it for that to be something that happens not just with everybody who looks just the same and has decided, like, socially we all fit together, but to include, but to that kind of, for that kind of joy to include your grandparents and your parents. Would you imagine that? And some of you have beloved grandparents. A lot of us have lost our grandparents. But imagine you are at a party that is just raging and your grandpa is dancing. And you love it. And you're all there together. You youths and the graybeards are just moving. Have you, let me ask you that, have you ever experienced something like that? It's so uncommon. I'll tell you, the only place I ever see that is at weddings. And as a pastor, I get to see a lot of weddings. And it's not every wedding. A lot of weddings, it's just a few people who get up. But every now and then, there's a wedding where everybody gets into it. I was at a wedding like this fall. And some of you also were there. It's for some friends who are with us in worship tonight, or this morning. And that day when they were married, and I'll say it's Tom and Sunrisa, the ceremony itself was so joyful, I cried and snotted out most of the moisture in my body. And it was. And it was joyful for one reason. These two, and then their love was reflected back in the hundreds of people who gathered and prayed for them at their ceremony, and it was so good. And I remember at the end of the ceremony thinking, it couldn't get any better. How often do you find yourself thinking in life, it just couldn't get any better? Do you find yourself thinking that often enough? I'm serious, do you? Probably you don't, do you? These images say God has a life for you, which is a life where you think all the time, it just couldn't get any better. Do you want that? I'm asking you, do you? I so want it. Is your life far away from it? Mine is. More than I wish. After the ceremony, we get out on the dance floor and the music starts and most people are getting out there and I'm thinking, this is really remarkable. And I'm out there and I'm bouncing because that's all I can do. But as I bounce, I don't know if this has ever happened to you, it seems like the people around me are moving in slow motion as I look around. This actually happened to me. And I found myself reflecting and thinking, this is so fun. This is amazing. And I saw all the different people that are moving. I thought, I love this. I'm so lucky. And then the lights go down and a song starts. It's a song by a guy named Rob Bass, I think. It takes two to make a thing go right. Do you know that song? And then we back out and then there's, I think it was five or six women come out with these ridiculous costumes on and headbands and neon headbands and they start doing this choreographed dance and their t-shirts spell Sassos and that's my friend Tom's last name. And they work out this dance that they've obviously performed together. And what happens is all of the people who are watching are cheering so loudly, it hurts my ears, but we are having such a magnificent time. And I take time to describe this to you because this image here that God is giving to the exile says, this is what life will be like. After these women, and my wife was one of them, finish their dance, and they move off, and everybody's screaming, then the song Johnny B. Goode starts. You know that song? And then there's this guy, who I've just now found out from Tom, is called John, who gets on the floor and starts to sing, or so it appears, the Chuck Berry song. This guy was probably a child when Chuck Berry was a kid. He could be Chuck Berry. He's a graybeard, and he is... I can't tell if he's lip-syncing or really singing it because it looks that good. And he is so into it and people are so freaking out. I'm thinking to myself, he's going to have a heart attack. And I think, you know what? This would be the best possible way to end your life. Like, to the exiles, the word that comes is this is how good your life is going to be. It's going to be a celebration. And then the last one, which I'll touch on very briefly. The priests will have their fill of fatness. It means that the richest and most prized pieces of meat, because the fat that was marbled, you know that fat, that or the meat that has a marble in it? It's just so rare. And what used to happen, to their shame, is the priests used to steal that from the sacrifices. It was so rare. But the prophet's saying, look, there'll be more than that, more than enough of that to go around. Everybody will come and have their fill. They will be, and that last word there, they're going to be satisfied, is what we want deep down inside. We want satisfaction. And actually, I think we were really made for it. In the right ways, we were made to be truly satisfied. And the word of hope to the exiles is there will be a day where all that happens. If you're an exile, you are wondering, when is it going to happen and how do I get it? And the answer is in verse 11. Let's see that. Look at verse 11. It's put in these words, it's put in the present as if it's or as if it's already happened, but it's still a word of promise for them. It's where God says, For the Lord has ransomed Jacob. That's a word for Israel, for the people of God who are in exile. He's ransomed them, and he has redeemed him from hands too strong for him. Very briefly, those exiles knew that the hand which was too strong for them was the hand of Babylon, the power, the political power that had kept them in exile and held them from having true life. They knew that only if they were saved from that hand would they be okay. And those two words, ransom and redeemed, both of them are words that basically mean the same thing. To ransom someone is to give an adequate amount of money to free them from a captivity which they are unable to free themselves from. To redeem means to restore something that has been taken away and is forever forfeited unless an adequate amount of capital is given to the one who holds them prisoner, so that then and only then can they be redeemed. And this word in verse 11 for them is a word of something to look forward to. It's a word that says to them, there will be a day where it will be true to say in the present that the Lord has in fact ransomed you and redeemed you. And if you were in exile, you would know you could only have those five beautiful pictures of life once God redeemed or ransomed you, rescued you. And so you would have to look forward to the time when that good thing would happen. And that's what you would have to believe. But now, I'm going to ask you to shift your perspective away from where the exiles were to where you are today. And some of you know this already, but others may not know this. This future promise for them is a reality for every one of us in this room, because when God came in Christ, he redeemed humanity from the hand that was too strong, which was much stronger than Babylon. I mean the hand of sin and death. And if you want to know why life is so difficult and often feels so hopeless, it's because you yourself and so many of us live within the grips of sin and disobedience that we still turn away from God ourselves. And that's what makes life so utterly miserable. And here, you must understand that the words in verse 11, which were a future hope for them, are a past reality for you. And you might wonder how. And we can answer that question another time. But for this morning, what you must know is that the definitive and clear and unanimous voice of the New Testament witness is that the hope in Jeremiah has been completely fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Because when God in Christ came, he gave his life a ransom. Those were his own words. That in Christ, God was reconciling the worlds to himself, redeeming them from the hand which was too strong. And he did that by giving his life. In 1 Peter, we read there that it was the blood of Christ which redeemed us from our own exile. And that has happened in the past for all of us. I know that some of you who believe it and trust it still don't experience your lives like those pictures. Am I right about that? And I know others of you who haven't yet believed it should be asking, well, if that's true, how can I get that life? And that's the last question I want to address in this message for you. It is, okay, if it's true that we've been redeemed and ransomed by Jesus, then how can we experience the life that you've described there? Because I also don't always experience it, so how can I experience it? Are you wondering, I hope you are. This is my favorite thing to say to you. The way that any one of us experiences that life, the life of being with the shepherd and singing like we're on a hill, or having a life that's like a watered garden, or being so joyful that we can't stop dancing with everyone, or being satisfied as with a rich feast, is in relationship to Jesus. It's only when a person has a living and vital and real relationship with Jesus that they will experience these things. And the way that happens is by grace through faith. And I want to explain those two words briefly. The reason I say by grace is that it is not true that you or any of us must or can do anything to earn God's favor or earn his redemption or his ransom. Jesus did that for us. And so by grace, we are the recipients of this life, but not grace all by itself as some bare fact out there that has nothing to do with our own lives, but through faith. And what that means is that you simply have to choose to trust Jesus. And when you choose to trust him in a living way, you will begin to experience the life of promise, which was described as a future hope in Jeremiah and which is a present reality for every one of us who is willing to trust Jesus. Does that seem too simplistic? Trust Jesus. That's all I can say. I say it to myself as I say it to you. How would it look? Let's see the last slide. And I'm going to ask the musicians to come forward because they're going to help us with a song. Let's just look very briefly at the simple description of each one. A flock. You know that Jesus said, I am the good, help me out here, shepherd. And so if you want to experience the life of being held by him as a shepherd holds the sheep, then stay in the flock. Stay in this flock, practice listening to the shepherd. That's something you can do. If you don't work on listening to the shepherd, don't be surprised that you don't experience life as if you are held by the shepherd. Listen to him. Sing aloud. This one's easy. Can you guys start that song? We're going to sing together. So how do you sing like a choir on a hill and have a life that's like that? You sing with other people. And let me make this even more emphatic, that you sing about the goodness of the Lord. And that means that you make a conscious decision, listen now, to take your eyes off of all the things that are wrong in your life now and then so that you can put them on how good God is now and then. Yes? You can do that. Do you know that the way you think and the way that you experience your life actually often comes down to what you choose to focus your energy on all the time? So there's a second thing you can do to experience that life is sing about how good God is. We're going to do that in a moment. Here's a third. You will never languish again when you let the gardener come into your life and give you the water that you need to grow. Jesus also said, if anyone comes to me and believes in me, trusts me, I will give that person living water. So again, you come to Jesus and trust, and you'll never languish again. Rejoice in the dance. Well, what do I say here? If you're not a good dancer, so what? If you've got a lot of terrible things in your life, come to the Lord of the dance and let him invite your spirit to stand up and be glad. Because he promises if you'll bring to him your grief and your sorrow. And that means not trying to manage it yourself, but bring it to him in prayer. In your own mind, you bring it to him and talk to him about it. He promises to turn that upside down into joy and dancing. And then the last thing that you should do is just be satisfied. And there's one who satisfies us perfectly, and it's Jesus. And the way he satisfies us, listen to this, is by giving himself to us. When we have communion, we're going to break the bread, and that's his body given to us to feast upon. And when we pour the wine, that's his blood poured out for us, which makes us perfectly clean. Now, this song right here, you hear this, which we're going to sing in a moment, is the song in which we ask at first, what can wash away my sin? That's a question that says, what can free me from exile? What can do it? And the answer that we'll sing together is nothing but the blood of Jesus. What can make me whole again? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. And I love this song. I love the way it sounds. I love what it feels like to sing it with the people around me. And I love what it means. And so here's the last thing I'll say before we sing it together. If you have never chosen to accept God's grace by faith, and this morning you feel in your heart that it's time for me to move into that place where I say yes to Jesus and I experience this freedom from exile, or if you've been in exile as a Christian and it's time for you to yet again come back to that place, you let this song be your prayer. Would you do that? And I want us to stand up and sing it together. Let's do that. Let's let it be the way we close our sermon and our time together in worship.